Hello, I'm Bruce Selry. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Are you satisfied? Are you really satisfied? When you look at the money you've earned and all of the accomplishments you've achieved through your life, do you feel satisfied? If you constantly feel like you need more and more, maybe you're caught in the culture of never enough. Manisha Thakur is the founder of Money Zen, and she talks about ways to feel fulfilled financially and emotionally in her new book. It is called Money Zen, The Secret to Finding Your Enough. She's here to talk about it. And weddings. Oh my gosh. So fun. So many tears. All that. If you have recently gotten engaged, you're probably already thinking about what that wedding will look like and maybe how much it's going to cost. That wedding, if you look at the averages, could come at a hefty price. Karen Cleveland is the co-author of the new wedding book, A Guide to Ditching All the Rules. And she'll be here to talk about how to think about that day, especially when it comes to the financial aspect. Then not everyone gets fair access to financial services, especially those who are newcomers to Canada. It is a real challenge for people. Nova Credit is a credit bureau trying to make that easier for immigrants. And that's by helping them get access to credit history in their home country, their prior country. Founder and CEO Misha Esipov is here to talk about how it works. Plus, we'll speak with Adam Carroll. He is the founder of The Shred Method, about a different way for people to pay off their mortgage more quickly. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. A newcomer to Canada faces many, many challenges. I mean, finding a place to live, place to work, worship, shop, all that, and so much to learn. Some simple things, and some really, really not simple, like learning how our financial institutions work. One element in particular in that broad realm is credit. It's not simple. It is critical to a functional life here in Canada, but can be difficult for newcomers to access. Nova Credit is a credit bureau that aims to address this challenge. Joining me now is the CEO and founder, Misha Esipov. He is in New York City. Hello there.
Hey, good. Thanks for having me on.
What is the problem that you are trying to solve?
So, I mean, you kind of alluded to this already, but, you know, millions of people move around the world. Canada receives almost a million people every year. As you look at Canadian demographics, Canada is going to welcome somewhere almost 15 million people in the next 15, 20 years. And every time somebody arrives, they effectively have to start over. They don't have, they have to get a place to live, a credit card, a bank account, and so much more, but they need credit history in Canada to be able to access those kinds of things. And so when you arrive in Canada, you arrive what's called credit invisible. And what Nova Credit does is we allow people to move around the world, including moving now to Canada, and bring with them any financial history they've built in their home country. So if you move to Canada from, let's say, India or the UK, you can bring your credit history from those countries into Canada. And with that, you can get approved for products at partners of ours like Scotiabank.
I had a particular and personal experience when I moved to the US many years ago, and it's like I just dropped from Mars. Nothing mattered that I had done here in Canada, and that's still an issue for people arriving in this country. Why haven't the big credit bureaus signed off on this, solved this?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these industry problems that's been around since the very beginning of the credit reporting space. When you look at the big credit bureaus, they exist around the world, but they're really regional businesses. So no single credit bureau exists in every market that matters. And so what we've done is we've sort of solved this industry problem by partnering with the big bureaus, Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, CRIF, CreditInfo, various independent bureaus around the world, and brought together a global industry that has never really worked well together.
And in layman's terms, so how does your system work? Are you a translator? Do you metaphorically pick up the phone, call all the bureaus and put it into a little spreadsheet and then sell it off to a Canadian financial institution? How's it work?
Yeah, you can kind of think of us like the Rosetta Stone, right? So you, you've got credit history. Let's say you're moving to Canada from India. You connect to us and we say, hey, where are you from? You tell us you're from India. We pull your data from India. We then use our Rosetta Stone and we translate that into a Canadian format and scores and analytics. And then we can deliver that on your behalf only with your consent and approval, to a bank of your choice.
What are some of the differences across different countries that you have had to account for? Because I know even, you know, countries that have massive economies and well-educated people, they don't necessarily work the same way when it comes to even the difference between credit versus debit or cash versus plastic.
Yeah, I mean, every country has its nuances. I think the biggest difference that exists around the world is there are some markets that just don't have credit bureaus. Like France is the only G20 economy that is that way. The next big one is this concept of positive versus negative credit reporting. So positive is what we're used to here in the US and in Canada, where the good and the bad is reported. So if you do repay on time, that information is reported into the bureaus, and that helps you improve your score over time. Whereas there are some markets that, like Brazil historically, that are what's called negative reporting, where only if you've been bad does that information get added into the bureaus. And so I can go a lot deeper in this kind of thing, but there are nuances country to country that we've had to learn how to handle and normalize.
What benefit to a newcomer to Canada does engaging with Nova Credit provide? So if they have no credit history from another country, they are going to get, you know, some sort of financial product. Maybe it's a secured card. They're going to get training wheels. So does this speed up how quickly they can learn to ride a bike? And if so, by how much?
You got it. Exactly. I mean, the better your history, the more willing a financial institution or a bank will be to lend to you. So if you've got a lot of experience with, you know, having had a credit card or having had a mortgage before, you're going to have a good credit history in your home country. And that information can get you a type of product as if you had lived in Canada your whole life. So you can get a $15,000 or $20,000 credit card upon arrival from your very first day. You can get approved for an auto loan or a mortgage or a personal loan, despite being absolutely invisible to the credit system in Canada.
I was a victim of fraud here in Canada and had to work with my financial institutions, with the credit bureaus. It took, I don't know, 6 to 12 months until it was resolved and my credit score returned. I can imagine it is an order of magnitude more challenging when you're dealing with another country where either it's fraud or the data that comes through just is inaccurate in some way. What perspective would you have on that part of the dynamic for newcomers?
Yeah, so a core component of what we do is we authenticate the customer in order to pull their data. So what that means is we have a series of processes that we take a customer through to actually answer the question, are we confident that you are who you say you are? And there's different ways that we help manage that risk. But in taking a customer through that process, we are able to significantly reduce the risk of any fraud. And that's allowed us to create a system that is now being used by some of the biggest banks in the world, including HSBC, American Express, telecom providers like Verizon, and a number of other key banks and partners that we've worked with for many years.
Tell us about the credit passport specifically.
Yeah, so the credit passport is the flagship product of the company. We now have connectivity into about 25 different countries around the world. Over 2 billion people we can find information on with their consent. And the credit passport really is, you know, this global data dictionary, almost like a Rosetta Stone, that allows for someone's financial identity to compliantly move around the world. So if you, Bruce, tomorrow wanted to move back to the US or move to the UK or move to Singapore, we'd be able to take your prized Canadian history and use that history to get you approved for financial products all around the world.
What is required on the part of lenders? So I know you're not everywhere in Canada yet. Maybe you will be one day, but is it that the newcomer needs to apply to a lender who happens to pull from the Nova Credit database in order to get that benefit?
Yeah. So in a future state, you know, we believe every financial institution in Canada is going to be using the credit passport. I mean, the newcomer segment is just so important in Canada. And having more data results in better decisions and better value proposition. And in doing so, they can actually help, win more customers. Mm-hmm. Becoming a customer of ours, similar to what, you know, Scotiabank announced with us a few weeks ago, involves learning how to read our Rosetta Stone, learning how to read the credit passport and being able to ingest that into their decisions to help make more informed and better decisions.
What are two or three things, and I'm going to ask you to generalize here because every newcomer to Canada is completely different. So I'm going to ask you to generalize. What are two to three things that they need to know that they may not know about how the credit system works here in this country?
You start over. That's the first thing. And it takes a long time to build a good credit profile in Canada. You need to get multiple credit lines. You need to spend, multiple months, if not years, repaying those credit lines. And it takes a few years to build a healthy and a good credit profile. And only once you have a good profile, can you start to get approved for prime products, meaning, low interest rate or higher credit limit products that can actually serve you day to day. And that problem that's been around for decades is one that, is faced by almost 1 million people a year. And that problem has now been solved. And that problem can be solved by allowing information to flow into Canada. And that information can help people land on their feet and accelerate their path of integrating into Canada.
If you could snap your fingers and change one thing about the environment for newcomers to Canada, what would it be?
I would allow the same way that banks, all of the banks in Canada rely on the two Canadian bureaus. I would accelerate the path with which they rely on the credit passport. We think it's an inevitability that every bank is going to want to be able to use this information, and we want to make it easier. And obviously, you've been in this space for long enough to know that it's not easy to sell to big banks. Banks love to press the big red button and reorg and adjust where people are sitting. And so it's just there's a certain inertia required to break through to be able to partner with these kinds of, some of the largest companies in Canada. And, we'd love to find ways to accelerate that.
Yeah. Well, best of luck. And I don't know, welcome to Canada.
Thank you. Well, we're coming up there as much as we can. So it's only an hour away. I'll be back in a few weeks. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Thanks for being here. Misha Esipov was in New York City joining us to talk about Nova Credit and their effort to ensure that people who are newcomers to Canada don't lose credit for behavior in the credit world that they may have in their home country. Coming up next on Moolala, Money Zen founder Manisha Thakur is here to talk about her book, Money Zen, The Secret to Finding Your Enough. And later, the shred method. This has nothing to do with your abs, though every time I read that phrase, I think they're talking about my abs. They are not talking about your abs. It is a program that claims to help you pay off your mortgage in record time. Founder Adam Carroll is here to talk about how it works. If you don't want to wait an entire week to listen to another episode of this show, you can listen to Moolala anytime. It is so simple. And we have, I think we're in season 7. We have tons and tons of archives, both of full shows and of specific segments. So you go to wherever you listen to a podcast, and you know the list of them, and download one to your phone, set up a subscription so they just come to your phone as they arrive. You can also go to moolala.ca. And the thing that I love about that is you can search by topic or by guest names super easily. So, do that. Get a little moolala into your life.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. How much is enough? How much is enough? Certainly, when it comes to money, the answer is different by individual. No one would have the exact same answer. But I think what is similar is that even if you hit that number, you may still not be satisfied with whatever your enough is. Manisha Thakur has worked in financial services for over 30 years. She is the founder of Money Zen, and we have had her on this program many times in the past. She has a new book. It is called Money Zen, The Secret to Finding Your Enough. And she's here to talk about tips for living a rich life that satisfies both your financial health and your, as she calls it, your emotional wealth. Manisha, great to see you today.
Always great to be with you, Bruce.
And I love that you're joining us on video from your place in Maine. And to our listeners out there who can't see the shot, she did show me the ocean out the window. She's facing me and paying attention to me, but really there is this vast and glorious ocean beyond. I want to start with this, the culture in which we live. I think this is critical context here. For so many people, in fact, I think it's fair to say the majority of people, we live in the world of there is never enough. Can you talk a bit more about that, about the world that we live in?
There's a famous quote by John D. Rockefeller where he's reputed to have said in response to a reporter who asked him how much is enough money. And he said, just a little bit more. And that really sums up what the messages are that are bombarding us these days. I meet so many people who feel no matter how much they earn, how many accomplishments they achieve, how much praise they receive, it's never enough. And they feel that they are never enough. And the reason is because the finish line keeps moving forward for a variety of reasons, but two of which are cultural norms and societal influences.
You have done in your past all the right things. You went to a great college, you did a Harvard MBA, you had the right job, you did all the things. What was, and I'm going to ask you to see if there's a crystallizing insight, but what was it that opened your world into this even being a question? Because for so many people who walked exactly your path, it's never even a thought on their mind.
What happened was I got very sick. Mm. I had to take a medical leave of absence that lasted 9 months. Ugh. I literally, in this period, was able to stay awake about 5 to 6 hours a day. That's how ill I was. Mm. And so that makes you think a little bit about life. And as I came back to work, I was doing a prospective client meeting, and the client didn't feel comfortable sharing her exact numbers. So we ran an analysis on my personal finances, which I've done 1,001 times myself. But as we did it in front of her, and I listened to somebody else describe it, and I realized I had reached enough for what I needed in life, not private plane enough, but enough to cover what made me happy, which I realized while being very sick, was less than I would have thought before getting sick. And at the same time, I realized I was emotionally bankrupt. And I realized that financial health had come at the expense of my emotional wealth. And I wanted to understand, how did I get here? More importantly, how do I get out?
Yeah. That is an insight that I think will resonate with so many of our listeners here, especially those who, like you, have been very success oriented from a very young age in a very traditional way. So on the get out, what are some things that are on that path for people to reframe expectations, for them to alter how they think and how they behave?
Well, the first overarching thing is to know that studies show that there is a number, it's different for all of us, but there is a number of financial health, the point at which we're able to meet our basic needs and desires, not just the raw needs, with comfort and ease. We've got emergency funds set aside. We have a game plan for what we're setting aside for the future. Once we hit that point, earning more money above and beyond that will not increase our financial satisfaction if it is not done on a base of emotional well-being. And so that's the first thing to know. You can keep chasing as fast as you want, but once you cross over financial health, it's not going to make you happier. So before we even get to how do we get out, I wanted to just tee that up. Have you seen that, Bruce?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And it segues to something. You have a chapter called Hardwired to Hustle, which I love the alliteration. I love the idea is you're clearly not living if you're not out there working it, moving it, shaking it, and baking it.
That is true. And that brings us to step number one of getting out. So many of us end up on this path of becoming a human doing instead of living life as a human being because of what I call small T traumas, things that happened to us before the age of 25 that on the surface seem like, you know, when you're an adult and you look back like, oh my God, how could that still be bugging me? In my case, I was teased mercilessly between the fourth, fifth, sixth grade period. I was so ostracized and I sought solace in academics and my teachers because they were the only ones who accepted me. And then I moved into the real world and what replaced grades and teachers, but money and promotions. And so in order to let go of that hustle culture, one of the key things I had to do was dive back and understand what in my past it was that had caused me to use constant striving to heal, to cover up a wound that may now be long healed.
There is an expression about, what is it? The task takes the time allotted, or nature abhors a vacuum, sort of similar world here. As one dials down that hustle, they have the insight, they say, I'm dialing that down. How do you ensure that that insight can live with you for a period of time when you aren't running at 100 kilometers/miles, because you're in the US, per hour?
Well, the next two steps in this process help you live with that, because the next two steps out are understanding the cultural norms and the societal influences that push us in this way. And very briefly, the cultural norms I'm referring to are, you know, you meet someone, what do they ask you within three questions? What do you do? And then they make a judgment about you and you judge them. And you know, so we've gone from jobs to careers to callings, and we, as Derek Thompson from The Atlantic says, we worship at the altar of workism. So we define ourselves by work, and then we are exposed to what I call counterfeit financial culture, which are images that we see in the media that are just mathematically unrealistic. In other words, a police person living in a home that even a junior partner, an exclusive law firm couldn't afford, this sort of thing. And so when you combine that together, it makes you feel I'm not keeping up with people. If they can do it, then I should be able to do it. And so I do it, but I do it on credit. And so as you're, you know, dealing with childhood traumas, thinking about cultural norms, thinking about societal influences, if we have time, we can talk about evolutionary biology. But understanding that the way out is first through those pieces. And then there's a second step and a third step to get out.
Okay, I'm ready. Go.
All right. Step number two is to understand that as a result of those initial forces, many of us develop an equation in our head that we live to optimize that is toxic and leads to unhealthy beliefs and behaviors. It, for example, in my case, I came to believe my self-worth equaled my net worth. Yoga instructor I interviewed, self-worth equals number of students in my class and number of privates I have. Professor, self-worth equals number of papers I publish and how many times they're cited. So you want to identify what's on the other side, what's the question mark, self-worth equals. And then step three, you want to shed that and replace it with a new mindset that you're going to use as your North Star to guide how you spend your scarce resources of time and money. And that equation is financial health plus emotional wealth equals what I call money zen, the state where you have calm and confidence and clarity about both the relationship you have with money and the role it plays in your life.
What I love about the equation as a metaphor is that you're talking about it as an act of creation. Because when we think of 2 + 2 = 4, there's no one made that up. Like, that is an is. That is universally true. Everybody agrees on that. But the equations that you're talking about, to another listener, they would say to that yoga instructor, what? Or the professor, what? How does that equation make any sense? But to the holder of that equation, it is as true as 2 + 2 = 4.
Precisely. And so that's why by shifting over to X equals Y, which is so black and white, financial health plus emotional wealth is flexible. As you go through your life, each of those definitions will shift for you. There are seasons in your life where you'll focus heavily on increasing your financial health. Then there are other seasons where you will focus more heavily on investing in your emotional wealth. And there are times where your asset allocation between your investment in each of those is more like 50-50. But the key is, just like you rarely want to have 100% of all of your money in stocks or all of your money in bonds, unless you are making conscious decisions about how you are splitting your focus in those areas, it is really easy to end up in a balance that does not result in a state of happiness around your relationship and role of money in your life.
I can anticipate one criticism that a listener might have of our conversation, and it is this. We are really talking about the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like self-actualization and life's purpose and emotional health and all that. For many humans on this planet, for many listeners of this show, they're at the bottom of Maslow's. They're talking about security, food, roof over their head. How can you reapply the money zen approach to people for whom it is a battle just to pay the rent?
Yeah, I address this in the book directly, because this book is geared towards the two-thirds of mankind who are at least earning enough to cover Maslow's bottom hierarchy of needs. A third of people are just never going to get there, and it's horrible. There aren't social safety nets. They're not paid fairly. And this book is not a drive. That's a whole separate book that I should write. Mm. The thing is about this book is I didn't say this is for the top 1%. I said it's for the top two-thirds. And that's because many of us, in defining the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of the needs, what we think we have to have is not really what we have to have. For example, like a certain kind of house. Well, you know what? My cabin is 550 square feet. And let me just tell you, I feel like a princess living in this, you know? And so I never thought I would want to live in a 550 square foot cabin that didn't have a washing machine and a dryer. I literally wash my clothes by my hands and hang it up outside. And so what I have come to see is that many of us are leaking money. We're spending money in areas of our life to keep up with other people or because we think we should. And we don't even really question it, whether it's having a home that has more bathrooms than humans because your kids have gone off to college, or it's dressing in a certain way that is to impress other people, but left to your own devices is not how you would groom. So that's why the equation can flex. And what I find is, even if you are in that top, let's say 10%, people up there are leaking buckets of money too. And when they do this process, oftentimes they're able to redirect a lot of that towards charitable giving, towards community. So this is a very flexible framework if you are earning a living wage.
I really, really appreciate your time, Manisha, and your insight. It is always such a pleasure to talk to you. And I think this new book prompts some tough, thoughtful, and really, really helpful questions for people. So thank you for taking the time to join us today.
My pleasure. And if listeners are wondering if they suffer from this problem, just go to moneyzenquiz.com. Take the quiz. It'll let you know.
MoneyZenQuiz.com. It will let you know. Thank you for letting us know, Manisha. We appreciate it.
Take care, Bruce.
Manisha Thakur is the author of Money Zen, The Secret to Finding Your Enough. Kind of a helpful question for you to answer.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, we're going to talk to a guy by the name of Adam Carroll. He's going to talk about something called the Shred Method, which its objective is to help you pay off your mortgage in record time. But first, planning a wedding, attending a wedding, some really helpful insight on the weddings of today. The author of a new book, Karen Cleveland, will be here. She's actually co-author of the new wedding book, A Guide to Ditching All the Rules. She's got tips and tricks on budgeting and saving, and really, most fundamentally, rethinking what that ritual means to you. And get inspired to get a better handle on your money by signing up for the Moolala newsletter. So once a month, we'll send you a newsletter. It provides links to stories that we are working on SiriusXM, on this show, Moolala, on CityLine, on BNN Bloomberg, CBC Radio, wherever it is. To sign up for that newsletter, go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
You want to marry your partner forever, but the debt that might come with the wedding, you don't want that to be around until death do us part. It could be, it should be one of the happiest days of your life, but it could also be the most expensive. And it can be overwhelming when you think about having to budget for it, save for it, and all that stuff. So what are some things that you can do to limit your financial stress when it comes to planning a wedding? To share her insight, we're joined by Karen Cleveland. She is the co-author of the new wedding book, A Guide to Ditching All the Rules. I love that title. Hello, Karen.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to take a deep breath so I can prepare myself for your answer to my question. What is the average cost of a wedding in Canada these days?
Are you sitting down?
I am sitting down.
Approximately $30,000.
That is just, I cannot even, that is the price of a car, a used car, but the price of a car. Why do you think this number has climbed to this level? What are one or two things that are going on in our culture that have brought it to 30 grand?
I think it's a confluence of a couple factors, but I think, you know, we're a consumerist society where more is more, and you add in, you know, things like social media and the sort of, I joke, like the wedding one-upmanship, where everyone wants to feel like their wedding is just a little bit more special, a little bit more unique, a little bit more bespoke, and it's driving the cost through the roof.
I had a number of friends get married this summer, and I asked them, how was the wedding? What was the very best part? One said the vows. The other said the DJ. They just danced their faces off. Neither of those things are expensive, and the vows are free. No one said the flowers. No one said the venue. No one said the dress. How do couples determine what the priorities are for them?
Well, I think that's the part of the problem, frankly, is that a lot of couples are on autopilot, just sort of checking off the boxes of what they think a Western wedding has to look like with all of the budget trappings. And that was really the thesis of the book, is why are weddings the way that they are? Like, we're spending heaps of money on weddings. By some estimates, the cost of weddings have doubled in the past 10 years, but the average family income in the country has only increased by about 26%. So it just doesn't square. What's more, divorce rates aren't really budging. So I think it does beg the question, like, what is driving all of this hoopla?
You have a whole chapter called Overspending. Our relationship with money gets complicated. Our relationship with money is complicated in so many areas. How would you articulate the dynamic for a couple and for a family? Because for many, this is involving their parents. It's a much more nuanced thing than other purchases.
Mm-hmm. It's so complicated. And everyone loves a wedding, right? It's the most beautiful, hopeful occasion. It's laden with expectations, often cultural or generational. And for a lot of North American couples, it's almost a given that getting married is going to end in some sizable debt and some serious financial stress. And that's really concerning. It also doesn't bode well for a happy marriage. So check this out. There's a chapter in the book that looked at a review of 115 studies about divorce and found that there's a direct correlation. Couples who spend liberally, and I mean going into sizable debt for their wedding, are going to have poor outcomes, and they're more likely to divorce than couples who stick to a tight budget. Now, I don't think we can chalk up a wedding budget to the outcome of a marriage, but I do think it becomes sort of a bellwether for how a couple is able to navigate financial stress very early in their relationship.
What are some examples that you would offer in terms of couples who have made creative choices about how they host the wedding? So, you know, our venue was not a big banquet hall. It was a theater. It cost $1,000. It was nothing. We didn't, you know, and I mean, it was two dudes, so we weren't buying big gowns. We could have bought big gowns. We didn't buy big gowns, but all we bought was a shirt. We bought a shirt. What are some examples of the things that you have seen people do that may go against the norm, but also cost much less than the norm?
I think everything's on the table. So I would say one of the obvious examples that people sometimes feel uncomfortable pursuing is just to have a really small wedding. One of the easiest way to keep your cost down is have fewer people. Also, I've seen weddings that opt for like a brunch occasion rather than an evening reception, which guess what? Your bar bill is going to be an absolute fraction of that because people aren't staying up all night. But I don't think there's a one size fits all solution to how to manage your budget. I do think there's something really powerful and magical and empowering for couples to sit down and say, like, what do we really want? Like, we know what social media tells us what we want. And we know what sort of the general zeitgeist tells us we should want. But what's important to us? And that might be a condo, a down payment on a place to live. It might be an absolutely ridiculous honeymoon. And maybe they elope. Maybe that's their wedding. But I'd say it really comes down to what that couple feels like is honest and authentic and integral to them, and not just going through the motions of what a really big industry says you should have.
One of the areas where there isn't, I would argue, isn't sufficient discipline is on the budget, because a budget in its truest form is, you know, it's top down. There's a number. And then you make really, really, really hard choices to ensure you come in under that number. And what I think a lot of couples do is they don't actually budget. They tally the expenses and it becomes the bill. So based on what we want, this is the bill. What is some advice you have for people on actually having some discipline around the budgeting?
I couldn't agree more with that. You're right. They're tallying a bill for the wedding that they think they want versus the wedding that they can actually afford. And that's how you build a budget. You start with what money you can predictably save or that you know you have access to. And by having access to, I don't mean draining investments, pulling from your savings, maxing out your credit cards. I mean, like, pragmatically, as a couple, you can absolutely afford. If your family has said, look, we'd love to contribute X amount of money, that's amazing and very generous, but couples should not be going into their wedding planning assuming that anyone other than themselves is going to bankroll this. That I think is at the absolute core. And then realizing what priorities really matter to you. So you mentioned a wedding that you went to and people said the most important thing was their DJ. Cool. That should be the first line item in your budget. And then everything else should fall from there. But you really do have to make some hard decisions. You're probably not going to have a TV-worthy wedding on the budget of your dreams. You're going to have to give somewhere.
Yeah, because you won't have the drone camera and the four standalones and the audio on every human in the wedding party.
Yes.
It can be an extraordinarily stressful day for the bride, for the groom, for the other bride, for the other groom, whatever the makeup is, for the parents. It really can be stressful. And there are ways to throw money at problems to reduce the stress. One could be a wedding coordinator or a wedding planner or something. How do you factor that in, the cost benefit of the stress reduction? We had a producer for our wedding. Granted, she was a friend, so she didn't pay, but it was a skill set that made life so much easier on the day.
I think that that's a great solution. So knowing that you don't want to be playing sort of air traffic controller on your big day, you can tag in that really super organized friend that you think could function as a sort of project manager on the day and make sure that all your vendors are arriving on time, that they're being paid for the day. I worked in events for a lot of my career, so I had no problem doing that for my own wedding. Granted, it was only 50 people, so there was nothing really high stress or fast paced about it. But I think that's a conversation every couple should have. Wedding planners, of course, you pay for, but they might be able to unlock some savings in your wedding planning that might almost, the cost savings might sort of warrant their bill. But yeah, there's lots of different ways around that.
we talk a lot about the couples that the conversations the couples need to have. And I also referenced the families. In my circumstance, we were planning no flowers. And my mom was like, stop the action. Hold on. Mm-hmm. We got to have flowers. How do you illuminate some of the priorities that other people in that sort of second circle outside of the couple themselves that are real priorities for them?
Yeah, that's a great metaphor. If it's not the flowers, it's going to be, oh, you're not having a cake or you're not having a reception line. Yeah, the reality
then it's not
is that,
a wedding if you don't right? do those things.
Yeah, or not the wedding that they've clearly envisioned or conjured up. So that's an important thing to reconcile is as much as we have our own ideas about what our wedding might look like, which is deeply, deeply personal, everyone else is going to be projecting what they think your wedding should also be. And that is sometimes a budget conversation. Sometimes it's a relationship conversation. Look, I know that's really important to you, Mom. We'll have a couple of your favorite flowers at the front, and that's what we can work in our budget, and that's it. But I think being really careful with that, because once you open it up to, oh, we can't afford that thing, you're essentially opening up a conversation where someone can fix that with money. And then suddenly they're making decisions for you that right. they're paying for, and that might not feel right anymore.
Just before we go, I want to ask you about the guests, because for many weddings, the guests face a real financial obligation. Sometimes it could be a destination wedding. You could be a part of a wedding party that has multiple events prior and a, you know, bachelorette or bachelor party in Vegas and all that. How do you draw boundaries that are respectful of the couple, celebrate the friendship, and don't bankrupt you?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's so many important nuances there, like the closeness of the relationship. Like, are you talking about your sibling getting married or like your old college roommate? So I think the closeness of that relationship is probably going to dictate how much you're willing to disrupt your life and your budget to be part of that wedding in whatever way you feel is right. What I will say is that regardless of your decision, everyone appreciates kind wishes. Everyone appreciates a phone call saying like, I'm so happy for you. Like, you're clearly so in love. This is just the best. And whether that means you can't be there in person, like, you know, traditional etiquette dictates that you have an entire year to send a gift. So there's no pressure to have some extravagant present waiting for them on the day after the wedding, but really just showing up in a thoughtful, loving, caring way.
That is fantastic. Karen, congrats on the book and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Karen Cleveland is the co-author of The New Wedding Book, A Guide to Ditching All the Rules. It's a great resource. Lots and lots of creative ideas in there and a real way to shift your mindset about what the wedding means and what's important to you. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, a strategy that is about helping you pay off your mortgage in record time. It's called the Shred Method. The founder, and he calls himself a super user of this method, Adam Carroll, is here to talk about how it works. Now, we're talking about weddings. If you like lifestyle shows, I do. You are in luck. Well, I don't know if you're in luck. You'd be lucky to check out CityLine. It is the longest running daytime TV show in North America, and it is hosted by the best host ever, Tracy Moore. I talk about money on that show. To find out more, cityline.tv.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Okay, so unless you won the lottery or inherited a gazillion dollars, paying off your mortgage overnight is just not going to be possible for you, especially with rates as they are. And with rates as they are, it can feel like a distant dream to be mortgage-free. Like, when is that going to happen? How is that going to happen? So we're going to talk about a method that can reduce the time that you spend as someone paying those payments every single month. It is called the Shred Method, and it was created by Adam Carroll. He is here to talk about how this works and whether, you know, determine whether it might be a fit for you. He's in Des Moines, Iowa today. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Bruce. It's good to be with you.
Where did the name come from, first of all? Because, of course, I saw it in my email, and I'm thinking, is this an ab workout? Is this yet another ab workout?
Well, it started out as an ab workout, and then it just went horribly wrong for me.
Mortgage, so I
pivoted to money. No, candidly, a good friend of mine had coined the term, I want to shred my mortgage. And I was like, oh, I love the idea of shredding my mortgage, because candidly, I remember as a kid, my grandparents had a mortgage burning party.
Yeah.
And this was a thing years ago that people would do. They would burn their mortgage because they didn't have it any longer. And I thought today they would shred it. They wouldn't burn it necessarily. They'd probably shred it.
Right. They'd have it. They probably have a shredder in their home office. There's actually a book in Canada by Sean Cooper called Burn Your Mortgage. And he actually did pull out the piece of paper and light it on fire. But shredding, I think, is very 2025. How does this actually work?
So the way that this works is we are accelerating the amortization table. And we're doing it in a way, now that some people's eyes glaze over when I even use that word.
Yeah. Explain the word.
What I mean by it is, for most people in their mortgage, they'll have 30 years of payments. So they'll do 360 payments, individual payments to their mortgage company in order to pay off that loan itself. And what you must understand about how those loans are set up is the majority of the interest is charged upfront. It's just the way an amortized loan works is the majority of the interest is upfront. And the way we like to describe it, Bruce, is if you were to take a traffic light and set it on its side over your mortgage, the first 10 years are red light. The majority of the money that you're sending in is going to interest, not to principal. The second 10 years are yellow light. That means maybe we'll get to half and half, but it's not till the very end of that 10-year period. And then the last 10 years is green light, the majority of your payments going to principal. Yet what most consumers don't realize is that they're in that red light time period while they're in their home, and they might only be there for 5 to 7 years before they move on to the next one. And what that leaves them with is very little equity in their home, but sending a lot of money and interest to their lender over that amount of time.
So how do you work around that?
The way we work around that is by using the way we describe it is by using the bank's money against the bank. And what I mean by that is there is something set up called a shred account. And the shred account is essentially a holding account where your income is being dropped into. And so all of your income goes in, and our piece of software will calculate how much of that income is going towards expenses, how much is going to pay off debt. And if there is extra amounts, and if we can borrow a little bit extra beyond that in the shred account, it's going to be sent to these amortized loans like your mortgage, student loans, car loans, et cetera.
Is this effectively a lump sum? Like it'd be like if you got a bonus at work and you said, oh, great, I've got an extra couple grand, I'm going to throw it onto the mortgage.
It is to an extent, and I'll add an extra on that. And that is that if you were to get, let's say, $10,000 as a lump sum bonus from work, and you plug that into the shred method, the system would do the calculation of upcoming bills and expenses and income. And it might say, hey, you got 10 grand coming in, go ahead and send $13,782 to your mortgage. And so we're leveraging quite often 115 to 130% of whatever's coming in, but it's going against that long-term debt. And the difference on the end is that you might pay dozens of dollars in interest on the back end of that extra borrowed amount, but you're paying off, by paying off the mortgage, you're getting rid of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in long-term mortgage interest at the same time.
And what's the access to that additional $3,000? Where's that come from?
It's really central to that shred account, which by and large, what it ends up being is a line of credit. Could be a HELOC, a home equity line of credit, a BLOC for business owners, a business line of credit, or a PLOC, a personal line of credit.
And how does the math work? Because here in Canada, the best interest rate you can get is going to be a mortgage on your principal residence. A distant second would be a HELOC, so guaranteed against the equity in your home, but that might be prime plus one, prime plus more than that. Yep. So how does the math work here? I've got a great interest rate relatively on my home. I'm paying more to borrow on the HELOC.
Yes. And we get this question quite a bit. And the reality of the algorithm that powers this thing is that it's constantly determining how much it should leverage at any given point in time to make sure that it is always a benefit to make these lump sum payments in terms of how much interest you'll save versus how much it will cost you to borrow. So in real world terms, if you have a 4% mortgage and you're getting a 9% HELOC right now, it still works. But what will happen is it will begin to shift how much is leveraged at any given point in time, Bruce. So instead of, you know, when rates on HELOCs were at 4 or 5% as well, the system might say, hey, let's go long on the HELOC based on how much income you have coming in. So you might send 15 or 20 or 25,000 in. And now because rates are going higher on the line of credit, we're starting to see the system cap off how much actually you're going to be sending on that line of credit to much smaller amounts, but they might be smaller amounts in like 2 week intervals.
So here in Canada, one of the big questions for homeowners is what features do they layer onto their mortgage? And the more complicated, the more features you have, typically, the more interest you are going to pay. So a lot of people here have a lump sum privilege. It's typically capped. I mean, you can have it be more, but say it's 10% or 20% or something. Yep. How do you ensure that you set up that mortgage with the features that you need in order to pull this method off?
So the goal obviously would be the prepayment penalty. We want to be as low as possible or high a percentage as possible. So if we can get a 20%, you know, early payment limit, that would be preferable. In Canada, if I know the majority of mortgages we are dealing with in Canada are at a 10% prepayment. And quite a few of our shredders will hit that 10% mark relatively early. And so that's where we start to recommend what other accounts or where else do you want to send some of these lump sums that would make sense, whether that's blasting away other debt. It could be a rental property, commercial property. We're trying to figure out a different way to apply the lump sum where it would make sense for them.
And you make your money based on, what is it, a subscription to the SHRED method and that algorithm?
That's correct. Yep. Yep.
We're and you have clients, you have clients in Canada currently.
We do. Yep.
What are some things that you've learned from them? Because this is a very new concept that might be different for Canadians versus Americans. Because having lived in the US, there's a whole different context for mortgages here versus there.
Indeed. I would say one of the biggest adjustments that we had to make, and we really take this into account when first chatting with a user, is talk to us about the parameters of your mortgage. We've dealt with a couple folks in Canada that, you know, as you know, the interest rate will change, but the amortization schedule does not. And so the payment does not. The amortization table almost has to be kicked out farther. So if someone's at a 5% rate and all of a sudden the rate jumps to 6 or 6.5 or 7, but the payment remains the same, what the lender is doing is kicking out how long that person's going to be paying on their mortgage. And so we have to make sure that the math works prior to them even really signing up for SHRED. We want to make sure this is advantageous for you to do. And our goal, you know, to put it in the arena, is we want to make sure people are creating more and more equity in their home and have the ability to refinance when and if the rates come down. We're hoping that they do. But that they're not out over their skis on a line of credit. So we're going to encourage folks that, you know, even if you had a $10,000 line of credit, we might only ever use $4,000 to $6,000 at a time, but you're going to see that principal pay down on the mortgage, assuming that it makes sense on the interest rate.
I consider myself to be a pretty smart dude, and I think I have understood about 20% of the method, and it's not because you didn't explain it well. Yeah. It's because it is so antithetical to how we normally think and behave. So much more. I see on your website, there's lots more. I appreciate you having this intro conversation with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you, Bruce. And if people are interested, we've got a masterclass at theshredmethod.com that will teach you a little bit more about the process. And we're always happy to do a 20-minute call with anybody that's interested.
That's great. Adam, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thanks, Bruce.
Adam Carroll is the founder of something called the SHRED method. The objective is to pay off your mortgage faster. Kind of it's one of those things that make you go, That is our show for today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you have thoughts, comments, questions, story ideas about the show, please send any and all of that to ask@moolala.ca. To stay up to date on what's going on Moolala, subscribe to our newsletter, moolala.ca, and hey, subscribe to the show on your podcast platform. And while you're there, leave a review. That'd be great. On social media, I am at Bruce Celery on X. I hate that name. Or Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. We are really jazzed about helping people get a better handle on their money. So tune in next week. Thanks for listening and have a great day.